1. Emmett. At 9 in the morning, Emmett was walking home from the train station at 125th Street into West Harlem. 2 hours earlier, Sally had come downstairs into the Whitney's kitchen with the report that Billy was sound asleep. "He's probably exhausted," said Emmett. "I should think so," said Sally. For a moment, Emmett thought Sally's remark was directed at him, a jab for exposing Billy to so many trials over the preceding days. But after looking at her expression, he could see that she was simply echoing his own sentiments. Billy was worn out. So the two decided to let him sleep. "Besides," said Sally, "I'll need some time to wash the sheets and make the other beds." In the meantime, Emmett would take the train to Harlem in order to pick up the Studebaker. Since Billy was set on beginning their journey in Times Square, Emmett suggested the three of them meet there at 10:30.
"All right," said Sally, "but how will we find each other?"
"Whoever gets there first can wait under the Canadian Club sign."
"And where might that be?"
"Trust me," said Emmett, "you won't have any trouble finding it." When Emmett arrived at the body shop, Townhouse was waiting on the street. "Your car's ready," he said after they'd shaken hands. "You get your envelope back?"
"I did."
"Good. Now you and Billy can head out to California. And not a moment too soon." Emmett looked at his friend. "The cops came back last night," Townhouse continued. "Only it wasn't the patrolman. It was two detectives. They asked me the same questions about Duchess. But this time, they also asked about you. And they made it clear, were I to hear from you or Duchess and not let them know, I'd be buying myself a heap of trouble. Because a car matching the description of your Studebaker was seen near the home of Old Testament Ackley on the same afternoon that someone put him in the hospital."
"The hospital?"
Townhouse nodded. "It seems a person or persons unknown went into Ackley's house in Indiana and hit him on the head with a blunt object. They think he's going to be all right, but he hasn't come to yet. In the meantime, the boys in blue paid a visit to Duchess's old man at some flop house downtown. He wasn't there, but Duchess had been, with another white youth and a light blue car." Emmett passed a hand over his mouth.
"Jesus, you said it.
Look, as far as I'm concerned, whatever that motherfucker Ackley got, he deserved. But for the time being, you should probably gain some distance from the city of New York. And while you're at it, gain some distance from Duchess, too. Come on, the twins are inside." Leading the way, Townhouse took Emmett through the repair base to where the Gonzalez brothers and the one called Otis were waiting. With the Studebaker back under its tarp, Paco and Pico were wearing their big white smiles, two craftsmen eager to reveal their handiwork.
"All set?"
Townhouse asked.
"All set," said Paco. "Then let's do it."
When the brothers pulled back the tarp, Townhouse, Emmett, and Otis were silent for a moment. Then Otis began shaking with laughter.
"Yellow?"
asked Emmett in disbelief. The brothers looked from Emmett to each other, then back again.
"What's wrong with yellow?"
asked Paco defensively.
"It's the color of a coward," said Otis with another laugh.
Pico began speaking rapidly to his brother in Spanish. When he finished, Paco turned to the others.
"He says it's not the yellow of a coward. It's the yellow of a hornet. But she don't only look like a hornet, she sting like one too."
Paco began gesturing to the car, a salesman highlighting a new model's features.
"In addition to the paint job, we took out your dents, polished your chrome, and flushed your transmission. But we also put some extra horsepower under the hood."
"Well," said Otis, "at least the cops won't be able to recognize you now."
"And if they do," said Paco, "they won't be able to catch you."
The Gonzalez brothers laughed with shared satisfaction. Regretting his initial response, Emmett expressed his gratitude at some length, especially given the speed at which the brothers had done their work. But when he took the envelope of cash from his back pocket, they both shook their heads.
"This one's for Townhouse," said Paco. "We owed him one."
As Emmett gave Townhouse a ride back to 126th Street, the two laughed about the Gonzalez brothers, about Emmett's car and its brand new sting. By the time they pulled in front of the brownstone, they were quiet, but neither reached for a door handle.
"Why California?"
Townhouse asked after a moment. For the first time aloud, Emmett described his plan for his father's money, the plan to buy a rundown house, repair it, and sell it in order to buy two houses more, and thus
the necessity of being in a state with a large and growing population.
That's an Emmett Watson plan if I ever heard one, said Townhouse with a smile.
What about you? Asked Emmett. What are you going to do now?
I don't know.
Townhouse looked out the passenger side window at his stoop. My mother wants me to go back to school. She's got some pipe dream of me getting a scholarship and playing college ball, neither of which are going to happen. And Pops, he wants me to get a job at the post office.
He likes his, right? Oh, he doesn't like it, Emmett. He loves it.
Townhouse shook his head with a tempered smile. When you're a letter carrier, they give you a route, you know. The blocks that you have to lug your bag up and down every day, like some pack mule on a trail. But for my old man, it doesn't seem to feel like work, because he knows everybody on his route, and everybody knows him. The old ladies, the kids, the barbers, the grocers. Townhouse shook his head again. One night about 6 years ago, he came home looking real low, like we'd never seen him before. When Mom asked what was wrong, he burst into tears. We thought someone had died or something. It turned out that after 15 years, the powers that be had changed his route. They moved him 6 blocks south and 4 blocks east, and it nearly broke his heart.
What happened? Asked Emmett.
He got up in the morning, trudged out the door, and by the end of the year, he'd fallen in love with that route too. The two friends laughed together, and Townhouse put a finger in the air. But he never forgot the first route. Every year on Memorial Day, when he's got the day off, he walks the old one, saying hi to everybody who recognizes him, and half the people who don't. In his words, if you've got a job as a mailman, then the U.S. government is paying you to make friends.
When you put it that way, it doesn't sound so bad.
Maybe so, agreed Townhouse. Maybe so. But as much as I love my father, I can't imagine living like that, covering the same ground day after day, week after week, year after year.
All right. If not college or the post office, then what?
I've been thinking about the army.
The army?
Asked Emmett in surprise.
Yeah, the army, said Townhouse, almost as if he were trying out the sound of it on himself.
Why not? There's no war right now. The pay's pretty good, and it's all for keeps. And if you're lucky, maybe you get stationed overseas and see something of the world.
You'd be back in a barracks, Emmett pointed out.
I didn't mind that so much, said Townhouse. Falling in, following orders, wearing a uniform? That's just it, Emmett. As a black man, whether you end up carrying a mailbag, operating an elevator, pumping gas, or doing time, you're going to be wearing a uniform. So you might as well choose the one that suits you. I figure if I keep my head down, pay my dues, maybe I can climb the ranks, become an officer, get myself on the right end of a salute.
I can see it, said Emmett.
You know something? Said Townhouse. So can I.
When Townhouse finally got out of the car, Emmett did too. Coming around the hood, Emmett met him on the sidewalk, where they shook hands with the silent affection of the kindred.
The week before, when Billy had laid out his postcards and explained to Emmett how they were going to find their mother by attending one of the largest 4th of July celebrations in the state of California, Emmett had counted his brother's notion as fanciful at best. And yet, despite the fact that Emmett and Townhouse were two young men on the verge of heading out in different directions with no real assurance of where they would land, when Townhouse said at their parting, "I'll see you," Emmett hadn't the slightest doubt that this was true.
"What in the Lord's name?" said Sally.
"It's my car," said Emmett. "That looks about as much like a car as one of these signs."
They were standing at the northern end of Times Square, where Emmett had parked the Studebaker right behind Betty. Sally had good cause to compare his car to the signs around them because it was just as eye-catching. So much so, it had begun to attract a small crowd of passers-by. Reluctant to make eye contact with them, Emmett had no idea if they were pausing to snicker or admire.
"It's yellow," exclaimed Billy, as he returned from a nearby newsstand. "Just like the yellow of corn."
"Actually," said Emmett, "it's the yellow of a hornet."
"If you say so," said Sally.
Eager to change the subject, Emmett pointed at the bag in Billy's hand.
"What have you got there?"
As Sally returned to her truck, Billy carefully slid what he had purchased out of the bag and handed it to Emmett. It was a postcard of Times Square. At the top of the picture, peeking out from behind the buildings, was a small patch of sky,
and just like in the other cards in Billy's collection, it was an unblemished blue. Standing at Emmett's side, Billy pointed from the postcard to the landmarks.
You see, there's the Criterion Theater, and Bond Clothiers, and the Camel cigarette sign, and the Canadian Club sign, too.
Billy looked around in appreciation.
The man at the newsstand says that at night the signs are lit up, every last one of them. Can you imagine?
It's quite something.
Billy's eyes opened wide. Have you been here when the signs are lit up?
Briefly, Emmett admitted.
Hey, buddy,
said a sailor with his arm over the shoulder of a brunette.
How about taking us for a ride?
Ignoring him, Emmett got down on his haunches to speak with his brother more closely.
I know it's exciting to be here in Times Square, Billy, but we've got a long way to go. And we're just getting started.
That's right. So why don't you take one last look around? We'll say our goodbyes to Sally, and then we'll hit the road.
Okay, Emmett, I think that's a good idea. I'll take one last look around, and then we'll hit the road. But we don't have to say goodbye to Sally.
Why is that?
Because of Betty.
What's wrong with Betty?
She's a goner, said Sally.
Emmett looked up to find Sally standing by the passenger side door of his car with her suitcase in one hand and her basket in the other.
She overheated twice on Sally's trip from Morgan, explained Billy. And there was a big cloud of steam and clanking noises when we arrived in Times Square. Then she conked out.
I guess I asked a little more of her than she had to give, said Sally.
But she got us as far as we needed to go, God bless her.
When Emmett stood back up, Sally looked from him to the Studebaker. After a moment, he stepped forward in order to open the back door on her behalf.
We should all sit in front, said Billy.
It might be a little crowded, said Emmett.
It might be at that, said Sally.
Then putting her suitcase and basket onto the back seat, she closed the back door and opened the front.
Why don't you slide in first, Billy? She said.
After Billy climbed in with his backpack, Sally climbed in after him. Then she looked straight ahead through the windshield with her hands in her lap.
Thank you kindly, she said when Emmett closed the door.
By the time Emmett was in the driver's seat, Billy had unfolded his map. Looking up from it, he pointed through the window.
Officer Williams, the second policeman I spoke to, said the official start of the Lincoln Highway is on the corner of 42nd Street and Broadway. From there, you take a right and head toward the river. He said that when the Lincoln Highway was first opened, you had to ride a ferry across the Hudson, but now you can take the Lincoln Tunnel.
Gesturing to the map, Emmett explained to Sally that the Lincoln Highway was the first transcontinental road in America.
You don't have to tell me, she said. I know all about it.
That's right, said Billy. Sally knows all about it.
Emmett put the car in gear. As they entered the Lincoln Tunnel, Billy explained to Sally's apparent dismay that they were going under the Hudson River, a river so deep that he had seen a flotilla of battleships sailing up it just a few nights before. Then, for her benefit, he launched into a description of the elevated and stew and the campfires, leaving Emmett to his own thoughts. Now that they were in motion, what Emmett had imagined he would be thinking about, what he had looked forward to thinking about, was the road ahead. When the Gonzalez brothers had said that they put some extra horsepower under the hood, they weren't kidding. Emmett could feel it and hear it every time he put his foot to the accelerator. So if the highway between Philadelphia and Nebraska was reasonably empty, he figured they could average 50 miles an hour, maybe 60. They could drop Sally and Morgan late the following afternoon and be on their way, finally heading west, with the landscapes of Wyoming and Utah and Nevada stretching out before them. And at their terminus, the state of California, with a population on its way to 16 million. But as they emerged from the Lincoln Tunnel, having put the city of New York behind them, what Emmett found himself thinking about, rather than the road ahead, was what Townhouse had said earlier that morning, that he should gain some distance from Dutchess. It was a sound piece of advice, and one consistent with Emmett's own instincts. The only problem was that as long as the assault on Ackerley was an open matter, the police would be looking for Dutchess and for him. And that was assuming that Ackerley recovered. Should Ackerley die without regaining consciousness, the authorities wouldn't rest until they had one of the two of them in custody. Glancing to his right, Emmett saw that Billy had gone back to looking at his map, while Sally was watching the road.
Sally?
Yes, Emmett?
Why did Sheriff Peterson come to see you?
Billy looked up from his map.
The sheriff came to see you, Sally?
It was nothing, she assured the two of them. I'd feel silly even discussing it.
2 days ago, it struck you as important enough to drive halfway across the country, pointed out Emmett.
That was 2 days ago.
Sally?
All right, all right. It was something to do with that bit of trouble you had with Jake Snyder.
You mean when Jake hit him in town? Asked Billy.
He and I were just working something out, said Emmett.
So I gather, said Sally. Anyhow, it seems that when you and Jake were working your somethings out, there was another fellow there, a friend of Jake's, and shortly afterward, he was hit on the head in the alley behind the Bijou. This fellow was hit so hard, he had to be taken to the hospital in an ambulance. Sheriff Peterson knows it wasn't you who did it, because you were with him at the time. But then he heard talk of a young stranger being in town that day, and that's why he came to see me, to ask if you'd had some visitors.
Emmett looked at Sally.
Naturally, I said no.
You said no, Sally?
Yes, Billy, I did. And that was a lie, but it was a white lie. Besides, the idea that one of your brother's friends was involved with that business behind the Bijou is nonsense. Wooly would walk a mile out of his way to avoid stepping on a caterpillar. And Duchess? Well, no one who can cook a dish like fettuccine wutzits and then serve it on a perfectly set table would ever hit another man in the head with a 2x4.
And thus endeth the lesson, thought Emmett. But he wasn't so sure.
Billy, on the morning when I went into town, were Duchess and Wooly with you?
Yes, Emmett.
The whole time?
Billy thought for a moment.
Wooly was with me the whole time, and Duchess was with us for most of the whole time.
When wasn't Duchess with you?
When he went on his walk.
How long did that last?
Billy thought again. As long as the Count of Monte Cristo, Robin Hood, Theseus, and Zorro. It's the next left, Emmett.
Seeing the Lincoln Highway marker, Emmett shifted to the other lane and took the turn. As he drove toward Newark, Emmett could see in his mind's eye what must have happened back in Nebraska. Having been asked by Emmett to lie low, Duchess had gone into town anyway. Of course he had. Once in town, he must have stumbled on Emmett's confrontation with Jake and witnessed the whole sordid business. But if so, why would he have bothered to hit Jake's friend? Thinking back on the tall stranger in the cowboy hat leaning against the Studebaker, Emmett remembered his lazy posture and smug expression. He remembered how he had egged Jake on during the fight. And finally, he remembered the first words that the stranger had said. Seems like Jake's got some unfinished business with you, Watson. That's how he had put it, thought Emmett. Unfinished business. And according to the old performer Fitzwilliams, unfinished business is exactly what Duchess said he had with his father. Emmett pulled over and sat with his hands on the wheel. Sally and Billy looked at him with curiosity.
What is it, Emmett? Asked Billy.
I think we need to go find Duchess and Wooly.
Sally expressed surprise.
But Mrs. Whitney said they were on their way to Salina. They're not on their way to Salina, said Emmett. They're on their way to the Woolcott's house in the Adirondacks. The only problem is that I don't know where it is.
I know where it is, said Billy.
You do?
Looking down, Billy slid his fingertips slowly away from Newark, New Jersey, away from the Lincoln Highway, and up into the middle of northern New York, where someone had drawn a big red star.
Sally. When we were driving through Why Would Anyone on God's Green Earth Live Here, New Jersey, and Emmett pulled over to announce that we needed to go to upstate New York in order to find Duchess and Wooly, I didn't say a word. 4 hours later, when he pulled into a roadside motel that looked more like a place to drop off donations than to spend the night, I didn't say a word. And when in the motel's run-down little office, Emmett signed the register with Mr. Schulte's name, I didn't say a word then either. However, once we'd found our accommodations and I'd sent Billy into the bathroom to take a bath, Emmett directed his attention right at me. Adopting a measure of gravity, he said he wasn't sure how long it would take for him to find Duchess and Wooly. It could take a few hours, maybe more. But once he returned, the three of us could have something to eat and get a good night's sleep, and if we were back on the road by 7 in the morning, he guessed they could drop me off in Morgan on Wednesday night without going much out of their way. And that's when my allotment of not saying a word was all used up. "Don't you worry about going out of your way," I said. "It's no problem," he assured. "Well, whether it is or it isn't, doesn't make much difference. Because I have no intention of being dropped off in Morgan." "All right," he said a little hesitantly. "Then where do you want to be dropped off?" "San Francisco would do just fine." For a moment, Emmett looked at me. Then he closed his eyes. "Just because you close your eyes," I said, "doesn't mean that I'm not here, Emmett. Not by a long shot. As a matter of fact, when you close your eyes, not only am I here, Billy's here, this lovely motel's here, the whole wide world is here, right where you left it." Emmett opened his eyes again. "Sally," he said, "I don't know what expectations I may have given you or what expectations you may have come to on your own." "What's this?" I wondered. "Expectations he may have given me? Expectations I may have come to on my own?" I leaned a little closer to make sure I didn't miss a word. "But Billy and I have been through a good deal this year, what with losing Dad and the farm." "Keep going," I said. "You've got my attention." Emmett cleared his throat. "It's just that, given all we've been through, I think what Billy and I need right now is to make a fresh start together. Just the two of us." I stared at him a moment. Then I let out a little gasp. "So that's it," I said. "You think I'm inviting myself on the ride to San Francisco with the intention of becoming a part of your household?" He looked a little uncomfortable. "I'm just saying, Sally." "Oh, I know what you're saying, because you just said it. It came through loud and clear, despite all the hemming and hawing. So let me be loud and clear right back. For the foreseeable future, Mr. Emmett Watson, the only household I intend to be a part of is mine. A household where all the cooking and cleaning that I'll be doing is for me. Cooking my breakfast, my lunch, my dinner, cleaning my dishes, washing my clothes, sweeping my floor. So don't you worry about me putting a damper on your fresh start. Last time I checked, there were plenty of fresh starts to go around." As Emmett walked out the door and climbed into his bright yellow car, I thought to myself that there are surely a lot of big things in America. The Empire State Building and the Statue of Liberty are big. The Mississippi River and the Grand Canyon are big. The skies over the prairie are big. But there is nothing bigger than a man's opinion of himself. With a shake of the head, I swung the door shut. Then I knocked on the bathroom door to see how Billy was coming along. Accepting his brother, I guess I know Billy Watson better than just about anybody. I know how he eats his chicken, peas, and mashed potatoes, starting with the chicken, moving on to the peas, and saving the potatoes for last. I know how he does his homework, sitting up straight at the kitchen table and using that little rubber eraser at the end of his pencil to remove any trace of a mistake. I know how he says his prayers, always remembering to include his father, his mother, his brother, and me. But I also know how he gets himself in trouble. It was on the first Thursday in May. I remember because I was in the middle of making lemon meringue pies for the church social when I received the call asking me to come on down to the schoolhouse. I admit that when I walked into the principal's office, I was already a little miffed. I had just finished whipping the egg whites for the meringue when I received the call, so I had to turn off the oven and dump the egg whites in the sink. But when I opened the door and saw Billy sitting on a chair in front of Principal Huxley's desk staring at his shoes, I went red. I know for a fact that Billy Watson has never once in his life had cause to stare at his shoes. So if he's staring at his shoes, it's because someone has made him feel the need to do so, unjustly. All right, I said to Principal Huxley. You've got us here in front of you. What seems to be the trouble? It turned out that shortly after lunch, the school had what they call a duck and cover drill. In the middle of class, while the children were receiving regular instruction, the school bell rang 5 times in a row, at which point the children were supposed to climb under their desks and put their hands over their heads. But apparently, when the bell had rung and Mrs. Cooper had reminded the children what to do, Billy had refused. Billy does not refuse very often. But when he chooses to refuse, he does so with a capital R. And no matter how much cajoling, insisting, or reprimanding Miss Cooper resorted to, Billy simply would not join his classmates under their desks. I have tried to explain to William, explained Principal Huxley to me, that the purpose of the drill is to ensure his own safety, and that by refusing to participate, he not only puts himself at risk, he gives cause for disruption at the very moment when disruption could do its greatest harm to others. The years had not been kind to Principal Huxley. His hair had grown scarce on the top of his head, and there was talk in town that Mrs. Huxley had a friend in Kansas City. So I suppose there was some call for sympathy. But I hadn't particularly liked Principal Huxley when I was a student at Morgan Elementary, and I saw little reason for liking him now. I turned to Billy. Is this true? Without looking up from his shoes, Billy nodded his head. Perhaps you could tell us why you refused to follow Miss Cooper's instructions, suggested the principal. For the first time, Billy looked up at me. In the introduction to his compendium, Professor Abernathy says that a hero never turns his back on danger. He says a hero always meets it face to face. But how is someone supposed to meet danger face to face if he is under his desk with his hands over his head? Plain speaking and common sense. In my book, there's just no substitute. Billy, I said, why don't you wait outside? Okay, Sally. The principal and I both watched as Billy walked out of the office, still staring at his shoes. When the door closed, I turned to the principal so he could see me face to face. Principal Huxley, I said, while doing my best to maintain my good nature. Are you telling me that just 9 years after the United States of America defeated the forces of fascism around the world, you are chastising an 8-year-old boy for his refusal to stick his head under his desk like an ostrich in the sand? Miss Ransom, I have never claimed to be a scientist, I continued. In fact, when I was at the high school, I received a C in physics and a B- in biology. But what little I learned in these subjects suggests to me that the top of a desk is as likely to protect a child from a nuclear explosion as the hairs combed over your head are to protect your scalp from the sun. I know, it was not a Christian thing to say, but my feathers were up. And I only had another 2 hours in which to reheat my oven, finish making my pies, and deliver them to the church. So this was no time for serving soft-boiled eggs. And wouldn't you know it, when I left the office 5 minutes later, Principal Huxley had agreed that to ensure the safety of the student body, one courageous soul by the name of Billy Watson would be appointed as the duck and cover monitor. Henceforth, when the school bell rang 5 times in a row, rather than hide under his desk, Billy would go from room to room with a clipboard in hand in order to confirm the compliance of everybody else. As I said, I know Billy better than just about anybody, including how he gets himself in trouble. So I had no excuse to be surprised when, after knocking on the bathroom door 3 times, I finally opened it to find the water in the bathtub running, the window open, and Billy gone.
Emmett. After driving a mile down the winding dirt road, Emmett began to suspect he had taken a wrong turn. The man at the filling station, who knew the Wolcotts by name, had told Emmett that he should continue along Route 28 for another 8.5 miles, then take a right onto the dirt road bordered by white cedars. Emmett had measured the distance on the odometer, and though he wasn't certain what white cedars looked like, the road he came upon was lined with evergreens, so he took the turn. But a mile later, there was still no sign of a residence. Luckily, the road wasn't wide enough for Emmett to turn around. So he drove onward, and a few minutes later came upon a large timber house at the edge of a lake, beside which was parked Wooly's car. Rolling to a stop behind the Cadillac, Emmett got out of the Studebaker and walked toward the lake. It was late in the afternoon, and the water was so still, its surface perfectly reflected the pine trees on the opposite shore and the disparate clouds overhead, giving the world an illusion of vertical symmetry. The only sign of movement was from a great blue heron that, having been disturbed by the closing of Emmett's car door, had taken flight from the shallows and now was gliding silently about 2 feet above the water. To Emmett's left was a small building that appeared to be some kind of work shed, because resting nearby in a pair of sawhorses awaiting repair was an overturned dory with a breach in its bow. To Emmett's right was the house overlooking the lawn, the lake, and the dock. Along its front was a grand porch with rocking chairs and a wide set of steps descending to the grass. There would be a main entrance at the top of those steps, Emmett knew, but on the other side of the Cadillac was a path bordered by painted stones that led to a stoop and an open door. Climbing the steps, Emmett opened the screen and called inside. Wooly? Duchess? Hearing nothing, he entered, letting the screen door slam behind him. He found himself in a muck room with an array of fishing rods, hiking boots, slickers, and skates. Everything in the room was neatly put away except for the Adirondack chairs that were stacked in the middle of the floor. Over a rifle cabinet hung a large hand-painted sign with a checklist entitled Closing the House. 1. Remove firing pins. 2. Stow canoes. 3. Empty icebox. 4. Take in rockers. 5. Take out garbage. 6. Make beds. 7. Close flues. 8. Lock windows. 9. Lock doors. 10. Go home. Leaving the muck room, Emmett entered a hallway, where he stopped, listened, and called again for Wooly and Duchess. Receiving no response, he proceeded to poke his head into various rooms. While the first two seemed untouched, in the third, a cue and several balls had been left on the felt of the pool table, as if someone had stopped a game in mid-play. At the hallway's end, Emmett stepped into a high-ceilinged living room with various arrangements of couches and chairs, and an open staircase that led to the second floor. Emmett shook his head in appreciation. It was one of the finest rooms that he had ever seen. Much of the furniture was in the arts and crafts style, fashioned from cherry or oak, perfectly joined and discreetly detailed. Over the center of the room hung a large light fixture that, like the lamps, was shaded with mica, ensuring that the room would be cast in a warm glow once evening fell. The fireplace, the ceilings, the couches, the staircase had all been built larger than normal, but they were in proportion to each other and remained in harmony with a human scale, such that the room seemed at once cozy and generous. It wasn't hard to understand why this house had maintained such a privileged position in Wooly's imagination. It would have maintained a privileged position in Emmett's, had he had the luxury of growing up in it. Through a pair of open doors, Emmett could see a dining room with a long oak table, and down the continuation of the hallway, he could see doors leading to other rooms, including a kitchen at the end. But if Wooly and Duchess had been in one of those rooms, they would have heard him calling, so Emmett headed up the stairs. At the top of the steps, the hallway led in both directions. First, he checked the bedrooms to his right. Though they differed in terms of size and furnishings, some with double beds, some with single beds, one with a pair of bunks, they all shared a rough simplicity. In a house like this, Emmett understood, one wasn't meant to linger in one's bedroom. One was meant to join the family downstairs for breakfast at the long oak table, then spend the rest of the day out of doors. None of the rooms showed any sign of having been used the night before, so doubling back, Emmett headed for the other end of the hallway. As Emmett walked, he glanced at the photographs on the wall, intending to give them only passing consideration. And yet he found himself slowing his pace then stopping altogether in order to study them more closely. Though the pictures varied in size, all were of people. Among them were portraits of groups and individuals, children and adults, some in motion, others at rest. Taken separately, there was nothing unusual about them. The faces and clothes were ordinary enough. But taken together, there was something profoundly enviable about this wall of photographs in their matching black frames. And it wasn't due to the prevalence of sunlight and carefree smiles. It was a matter of heritage. Emmett's father had grown up in some version of this place. As he had written in his last letter, what had been handed down in his family from generation to generation were not simply stocks and bonds, but houses and paintings, furniture and boats. And when Emmett's father chose to tell anecdotes of his youth, there seemed no end to the cousins, uncles, and aunts gathered around the holiday table. But for some reason that had never been fully explained, Emmett's father had left all of that behind when he moved to Nebraska. Left it behind without a trace. Or almost without a trace. There were the trunks in the attic with their exotic stickers from foreign hotels, and the picnic basket with its orderly arrangement of utensils and the unused china in the hutch, remnants of the life that Emmett's father had relinquished in order to pursue his Emersonian ideal. Emmett shook his head, uncertain of whether his father's actions should give him cause for disappointment or admiration. As usual with such puzzles of the heart, the answer was probably both. Progressing down the hall, Emmett could tell from the quality of the photographs and the style of the clothing that the pictures were moving backward in time. Starting at some point in the 1940s, they receded through the 30s and the 20s, all the way into the teens. But when Emmett passed the side table at the top of the stairs, the photographs reversed course and began advancing through the decades. It was when he had returned to the 1940s and was looking with curiosity at a blank space on the wall that Emmett heard the music. Music coming faintly from somewhere down the hallway. Passing several of the rooms, he homed in on the sound until he stopped before the second-to-last door and listened. It was Tony Bennett. Tony Bennett singing that he would go from rags to riches if you'd only say you care. Emmett knocked. Willie? Duchess? When neither replied, he opened the door. It was another simply furnished room, this one with two small single beds and a bureau. On one of the beds lay Wooly, his stocking feet extending beyond the end of the frame, his eyes closed, his hands crossed on his chest. On the bedside table were two empty medicine bottles and three pink pills. With a terrible sense of foreboding, Emmett approached the bed. After saying Wooly's name, he shook him gently by the shoulder, finding him stiff to the touch. "Oh, Wooly," he said, taking a seat on the opposite bed. Feeling the onset of nausea, Emmett turned away from his friend's expressionless features and found himself staring at the bedside table. Having already recognized the little blue bottle as Wooly's so-called medicine, Emmett picked up the brown bottle. He had never heard of the medication printed on the label, but he saw that it had been prescribed to Sarah Whitney. In just this way, thought Emmett, does misery beget misery. For as good as Wooly's sister was at forgiving, she would never be able to forgive herself for this. As he set the empty bottle back down, from the radio came a jazz number, swinging and discordant. Rising from the bed, Emmett crossed to the radio and switched it off. On the bureau beside the radio was an old cigar box and a dictionary that could have come from anywhere. But leaning against the wall was a framed photograph that could only have come from the empty space in the hall. It was a snapshot of Wooly as a boy, sitting in a canoe between his mother and father. Wooly's parents, a handsome couple in their late 30s, each had a paddle resting across the gunwale, as if they were on the verge of setting out. From Wooly's expression, you could tell he was a little nervous, but he was laughing, too, as if someone outside of the frame, someone on the dock, were making a face for his benefit. Just a few days before, when they'd been outside the orphanage waiting for Duchess, Billy had explained to Wooly about their mother and the fireworks in San Francisco. And Wooly, in turn, had explained to Billy about the 4th of July celebrations his family would have here at the camp. It occurred to Emmett that this picture of Wooly sitting between his parents in the canoe could well have been taken on the very same day that Emmett had lain between his parents to watch the fireworks in Seward. And for perhaps the first time, Emmett had an inkling of why the journey west along the Lincoln Highway had become so important to his brother. Gently, Emmett returned the photograph to its place on the bureau. Then, after taking one more look at his friend, he went in search of a phone. But as he was heading down the hall, he heard a clanging coming from downstairs. Duchess, he thought. And the grief that had been welling up inside him was eclipsed by a feeling of fury. Descending the stairs, Emmett moved quickly down the hallway in the direction of the kitchen, once again homing in on the source of a sound. Stepping through the first door on his left, he entered a room that looked like a gentleman's office, but in disarray, with books pulled from the bookcases, drawers withdrawn from the desk, and papers scattered on the floor. To Emmett's left, a framed painting jutted at a 90-degree angle from the wall, while behind the painting stood Duchess, haplessly swinging an axe at the smooth gray surface of a safe. "Come on," Duchess encouraged as he hit the safe again. "Come on, baby." "Duchess," called Emmett once, then again more loudly. Startled, Duchess checked his swing and looked back. But upon seeing Emmett, he broke into a smile. "Emmett! Boy, am I glad to see you." Emmett found Duchess's smile to be as discordant as the jazz number that had come on the radio in Wooly's room, and he felt the same urgent desire to switch it off. As Emmett moved toward Duchess, Duchess's expression transitioned from elation to concern. "What is it? What's wrong?" "What's wrong?" Emmett said, stopping in amazement. "Haven't you been upstairs? Haven't you seen Wooly?" Suddenly understanding, Duchess set the axe down on a chair, then shook his head with a solemn expression. "I saw him, Emmett. What can I say? It's terrible." "But how?" blurted Emmett. "How could you let him?" "Let him?" repeated Duchess in surprise. "Do you seriously think if I had known what Wooly intended to do, I would have left him on his own? I've been keeping an eye on Wooly since the minute I met him. Not a week ago, I went so far as to take away the last bottle of his medicine. But he must have had another one stashed away. And don't ask me where he got hold of those pills." With all his feelings of impotency and rage, Emmett wanted to blame Duchess. He wanted to blame him badly. But he also understood that it wasn't Duchess's fault. And rising up within him, like bile in the throat, came the memory of his own assurance to Wooly's sister that all would be well. "Did you call an ambulance, at least?" Emmett asked after a moment, hearing his own voice falter. Duchess shook his head with an expression of futility. "By the time I found him, it was too late. He was already as cold as ice." "All right," said Emmett. "I'll call the police." "The police? Why would you do that? We've got to tell somebody." "Of course we do, and we will. But whether we do it now or later won't make any difference to Wooly. But it could make a big difference to us." Ignoring Duchess, Emmett headed toward the telephone on the desk. When Duchess saw where Emmett was going, he scrambled in the same direction, but Emmett beat him to it. Holding Duchess off with one hand, Emmett picked up the receiver with the other, only to find it silent, the service having yet to be restored for the season. When Duchess realized the phone was dead, he relaxed his posture. "Let's talk this through for a second." "Come on," said Emmett, taking Duchess by the elbow. "We'll drive to the station." Steering Duchess out of the office, Emmett walked him down the hallway, barely listening as Duchess tried to make some sort of case for delay. "It's terrible what happened, Emmett. I'm the first to say so. But it's what Wooly chose for himself, for his own reasons, reasons that we may never fully understand, and that we have no real right to second guess. What's important now is for us to keep in mind what Wooly would have wanted." When they reached the screen door in the muckroom, Duchess turned around in order to face Emmett.
You should have been there when your brother talked about the house he wants to build in California. I've never seen Wooly so excited. He could just picture the two of you living there together. If we go to the cops now, I'm telling you, within the hour, this place is going to be crawling with people, and we'll never get to finish what Wooly started.
With one hand, Emmett opened the screen door. With the other, he pushed Duchess down the steps. After Duchess stumbled a few feet in the direction of the overturned dory, he suddenly spun around as if he'd had an idea.
Hey, you see that boathouse? There's a workbench inside it with a whole selection of chisels and files and drills. They were of no use to me, but I bet you could get that safe open in a matter of minutes. After we liberate Wooly's trust, we can go find a telephone together. And once the ambulance is on its way, we can head for California, just like Wooly wanted.
We are not going anywhere, Emmett said, his face growing flush. We are not going to San Francisco or Los Angeles or Tinseltown. My brother and I are going to California. You are going to Salina.
Duchess looked at Emmett in disbelief. Why on earth would I go to Salina, Emmett?
When Emmett didn't reply, Duchess shook his head and pointed to the ground.
I am staying right here until I get that safe open. And if you don't want to stick around and help, that's your business. It's a free country. But I'm telling you, Emmett, as a friend, if you leave now, it's a decision you're going to regret. Because once you get to California, you'll realize that a couple of grand isn't going to get you very far. Then you'll wish you had your share of the trust.
Stepping forward, Emmett took Duchess by the collar just as he had at the Whitneys. Only this time he used both hands, and he could feel the fabric tightening around Duchess's throat as he rotated his fists.
Don't you get it? He said through his teeth. There is no trust, no inheritance, no money in the safe. It's a fairy tale Wooly cooked up so you would take him home.
As if in disgust, Emmett shoved Duchess back. Tripping over the stones that lined the pathway, Duchess fell on the grass.
You're going to the cops, said Emmett, if I have to drag you to the station.
But Emmett, there is money in the safe. Spinning around, Emmett discovered his brother standing in the doorway of the muckroom.
Billy, what are you doing here?
Before Billy could answer, his expression transitioned from one of instruction to one of alarm, prompting Emmett to turn back around. At the very moment, the Duchess's arm went into motion. The blow came hard enough to knock Emmett off his feet, but not hard enough to knock him unconscious. Feeling the coolness of blood on his brow, Emmett gathered his senses and rose onto all fours, just in time to see Duchess push Billy into the house and slam the inner door.
Duchess. The day before, after Wooly acknowledged that the notion of a combination had most certainly definitely slipped his mind, he wondered if I wanted to take a walk down to the dock. You go right ahead, I said. I think I'll take a moment to myself. When Wooly went outside, I spent a few minutes in front of Great Grandpa's safe, staring at it with my hands on my hips. Then, with a shake of the head, I went to work. First, I tried putting my ear against the metal and turning the dials to hear the clicks of the tumblers, like they do in the movies, which worked about as well as anything else you tried doing that you've seen in the movies. Retrieving the Othello case from my book bag, I took out my old man's knife. My idea was to force the point of the blade into the seam between the door and the casing and wiggle it back and forth. But when I put my full weight behind the knife, what gave was the blade, snapping clean off at the hilt. Forged, tempered, and burnished by a master craftsman in Pittsburgh, my eye, I muttered. Next, I went in search of some genuine tools, but after opening every kitchen drawer and rummaging through every closet, I proceeded to the mudroom, where I sifted through every cubbyhole and basket to no avail. For a moment, I considered shooting the safe with one of the rifles, but given my luck, I'd probably be hit by a ricochet. So I went down to the dock, where Wooly was admiring the view. Hey, Wooly, I called from dry land. Do you know if there's a hardware store in the neighborhood?
What's that?
he asked, turning around. A hardware store? I'm not sure, but there's a general store about 5 miles up the road. Perfect. I shouldn't be long. You need anything?
Wooly thought about it for a moment, then shook his head.
I've got everything I need, he said, with a woolly sort of smile. I'm just going to wander around a bit and unpack my things. Then I thought I might take a little nap.
Why not? I said. You've earned it. 20 minutes later, I was roaming the aisles of the general store, thinking they must call it that because it generally has everything but what you're looking for. It was like someone had tipped a house on its side and shaken it until everything that wasn't nailed to the carpet came tumbling out the door. Spatulas, oven mitts, and egg timers. Sponges, brushes, and soaps. Pencils, pads, and erasers. Yo-yos and rubber balls. In a state of consumer exasperation, I finally asked the proprietor if he had any sledgehammers. The best he could do was a ball-peen hammer and a set of screwdrivers. When I got back to the house, Wooly was already upstairs, so I returned to the office with my tools. I must have banged away in the face of that thing for about an hour, with nothing to show for it but some chicken-scratched metal and a sweat-soaked shirt. The next hour I spent searching the office for the combination. I figured a wily old moneymaker like Mr. Woolcott wouldn't be so careless as to leave the combination of his safe to the vicissitudes of memory, especially considering that he lived into his 90s. He must have written it down somewhere. Naturally enough, I started with his desk. First, I went through the drawers, looking for a diary or address book where an important number might be logged on the final page. Then I pulled out the drawers and flipped them over to see if he'd written it down on one of the undersides. I looked under the desk lamp and on the bottom of the bronze bust of Abraham Lincoln, despite the fact that it weighed about 200 pounds. Next, I turned my attention to the books, flipping through their pages in search of a hidden scrap of paper. That endeavor lasted as long as it took me to realize that flipping through all the old man's books would take me the rest of my life. That's when I decided to wake up Wooly, in order to ask him which of the bedrooms was his great-grandfather's. Earlier, when Wooly had said he was going to take a little nap, I didn't think anything of it. As I mentioned, he hadn't gotten much sleep the night before, and then he'd woken me at dawn in order to make the hasty exit. So I figured a nap was exactly what he intended to take. But the moment I opened the bedroom door, I knew what I was looking at. After all, I had stood on that threshold before. I recognized the suggestion of order, with Wooly's belongings lined up on the bureau and his shoes set side by side at the end of the bed. I recognized the stillness, set into relief by the delicate movement of the curtains and the murmur of a news broadcast on the radio. And I recognized the expression on Wooly's face, an expression that, like Marceline's, radiated neither happiness nor sorrow, but which did suggest some semblance of peace. When Wooly's arm had fallen from his side, he must have been too far gone or too indifferent to bother lifting it up, because his fingers were brushing the floor, just like they had at the Hojo's. And just like then, I put his arm back where it belonged, this time crossing his hands on his chest. At long last, I thought, the houses, cars, and Roosevelts had all come tumbling down. The wonder is he hath endured so long. As I was leaving, I turned off the radio, but then I turned it on again, thinking that in the hours ahead, Wooly would probably appreciate having the occasional commercial to keep him company. That night, I ate baked beans out of a can and washed them down with a warm Pepsi Cola, the only things I could find in the kitchen to eat. So as not to crowd Wooly's ghost, I slept on a couch in the great room. And when I woke in the morning, I went right back to work. In the hours that followed, I must have hit that safe 1,000 times. I hit it with the hammer. I hit it with a croquet mallet. I even tried hitting it with the bust of Abe Lincoln, but I couldn't get a good enough grip. Around 4 in the afternoon, I decided to pay a visit to the caddy in hopes of finding a tire iron. But as I was coming out of the house, I noticed that the rowboat overturned on a pair of sawhorses had a sizable hole in its bow. Figuring that someone had put it there to repair it, I went into the boathouse looking for an implement that might prove useful. Sure enough, behind all the paddles and canoes was a workbench with a slew of drawers. I must have spent half an hour going over every inch of it, but all it offered up was a new assortment of hand tools that weren't going to get me much further than the ones from the general store. Remembering that Wooly had mentioned an annual fireworks display at the camp, I tore the boathouse apart looking for explosives. Then, just as I was about to walk out in a state of moral defeat, I found an axe hanging between two pegs on the wall. With the whistle of a lumberjack on my lips, I sauntered back to the old man's study, took up a position in front of the safe, and began to swing. I couldn't have made contact more than 10 times when suddenly, out of the blue, Emmett Watson comes bursting through the door. "Emmett," I exclaimed, "boy, am I glad to see you." And I meant it, for if there was anyone I knew in this whole wide world who could find a way to get into that safe, it was Emmett. Before I had a chance to explain the situation, the conversation got a little off course, if understandably so, for having arrived while I was in the boathouse and finding no one home, Emmett had gone upstairs and discovered Wooly. He was clearly rattled by it. In all probability, he had never seen a dead body before, certainly not the body of a friend. So I really couldn't fault him for throwing some blame my way. That's what rattled people do. They point a finger. They point a finger at whoever's standing closest. And given the nature of how we congregate, that's more likely to be friend than foe. I reminded Emmett that I was the one who'd been keeping an eye on Wooly for the last year and a half, and I could see that he was cooling down. But then he started talking a little crazy, acting a little crazy. First off, he wanted to call the cops. When he discovered that the phone was dead, he wanted to drive to the station, and he wanted to take me with him. I tried talking some sense into him, but he was so tightly wound, he marched me down the hall, pushed me out the door, and knocked me to the ground, claiming that there was no money in the safe, that I was going to the police station, and that if necessary, he was going to drag me there. Given the state he was in, I have no doubt that's exactly what he would have done, no matter how deeply he would have regretted it later. In other words, he wasn't leaving me many options. And fate seemed to agree, because when Emmett knocked me down, I landed on the grass with my hand practically resting on one of those painted stones. And then out of nowhere, Billy pops up, just in time to draw Emmett's attention in the other direction. The rock that I had my hand on was the size of a grapefruit, but I wasn't looking to do any serious damage to Emmett. I just needed to slow him down for a few minutes, so he could regain a little perspective before he did something he couldn't undo. Crawling a few feet out of my way, I picked up one that was no bigger than an apple. Sure, it knocked him to the ground when I hit him with it, but that was more from surprise than from the force of impact. I knew he'd be back in the swing of things before you knew it. Figuring if anyone could talk some sense into Emmett, his brother could. I dashed up the steps, ushered Billy into the house, and locked the door behind us.
"Why did you hit Emmett?" Billy cried, looking more rattled than his brother. "Why did you hit him, Duchess? You shouldn't have hit him."
"You're absolutely right," I agreed, trying to settle him down. "I shouldn't have done it, and I swear I'll never do it again." Leading him a few steps from the door, I took him by the shoulders and made a stab at talking to him man to man. "Listen, Billy, there's been something of a snafu. The safe is here, just like Wooly said it would be. And I agree with you wholeheartedly that the money's inside of it, waiting to be claimed. But we don't have the combination. So what we need now is a little bit of time, some Yankee ingenuity, and plenty of teamwork." As soon as I had taken Billy by the shoulders, he had closed his eyes, and before I was halfway through my speech, he was shaking his head and quietly repeating his brother's name. "Are you worried about Emmett?" I asked. "Is that it? I promise there's no cause for concern. I barely hit him. In fact, he should be back on his feet any second now." Even as I said this, we could hear the knob rattling behind us, then Emmett pounding on the door and shouting our names. "There," I said, leading the kid into the hallway. "What did I tell you?" When the pounding on the door stopped, I lowered my voice in order to speak in confidence. The fact of the matter, Billy, is that for reasons I can't go into at this moment, your brother wants to call the authorities. But I fear that if he does that, we'll never get in the safe. There'll be no divvying. And that house of yours, the one for you and Emmett and your mother, it'll never get built. I thought I was making a pretty good case, but Billy just kept shaking his head with his eyes closed and saying Emmett's name. We're going to talk to Emmett, I assured him with a touch of frustration. We're going to talk with him all about it, Billy, but for the moment it's just you and me. And just like that, the kid stopped shaking his head. Here we go, I thought. I must be getting through. But then he opened his eyes and kicked me in the shin. Isn't that priceless? A moment later, there I was, hopping on one foot as he ran down the hallway. Jeez-o-peezo, I said, taking off after him. But when I got to the great room, he was gone. As God is my witness, even though the kid hadn't been out of my sight for more than 30 seconds, he had vanished into thin air, like Lucinda the cockatoo. Billy, I called out, looking behind one couch after another. Billy? From somewhere different in the house, I heard another doorknob rattling. Billy, I called to the room at large, with a growing sense of urgency. I know the escapade hasn't been playing out exactly as we planned, but the important thing is that we stick together and see it through. You, your brother, and me. All for one and one for all. That's when, from the direction of the kitchen, came the sound of breaking glass. A moment later, Emmett would be in the house. Of that, there was no doubt. Having no other choice, I made a beeline for the mudroom, where, finding the rifle cabinet locked, I picked up a croquet ball and threw it through the glass.